and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the possibility that while the situation with North Korea is bad enough, another crisis is looming with Iran, but this will be largely of Trump's own making. We will first speak with Steve Andreessen, who was Director for Defense Policy and Arms Control on the National Security Council and is currently a National Security Consultant at the Nuclear Threat Initiative and teaches at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. He joins us to discuss his article at the New York Times, "Is Trump Scheming to Kill the Iran Deal?" and assess whether the adults in the room, Generals Mattis, McMaster, and Secretary of State Tillerson, got rolled by the hardliners like Bannon, who have Trump's ear. Although the adults were able to get Trump to certify that Iran was sticking to the P5 plus one agreement for now, the price they paid was to have Bannon put in charge of a group of ideologues who will look for a way to decertify Iran within the next 90 days to find a pretext to resume sanctions and open the way for military action. Then we'll examine further the likelihood of Trump starting a war with Iran and speak with Dr. Trita Parsi, the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. He joins us to discuss his article at Alternet, "This October, Trump Will Try to Start a War with Iran. Trump Plans to Sabotage the Nuclear Deal," and explain how Saudi Arabia's ruling family wants to fight Iran to the last American soldier, and what a gift it would be to the hardline mullahs and Revolutionary Guards to have the great Satan go to war against Iran. Then finally, we'll look into why Trump is imposing sanctions on Venezuela's new dictator, Maduro, for killing democracy there via a phony referendum, while praising Erdogan for his recent electoral coup as Turkey's wannabe dictator rolls back democracy and jails thousands of political opponents. Max Hoffman, the Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, where his research focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, joins us to discuss Erdogan's show trials underway and the reshuffling of the top brass of Turkey's military. And joining us now is Steve Andreessen, who was the Deputy for Defense Policy and Arms Control on the National Security Council staff from 1993 to 2001, and is currently a National Security Consultant at the Nuclear Threat Initiative, and he teaches at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. He has an article at the New York Times with Steve Simon, "Is Trump Scheming to Kill the Iran Deal?" Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Andreessen.
Ian, thank you for having me.
Well, a pleasure, Stephen. And from the foreign policy article, which I found alarming, I've tried to look into it a little bit further. Apparently, the meeting that took place at which Trump sort of grudgingly agreed to certify Iran was sticking with the P5 plus one deal, the so-called Obama deal that Trump hates. That meeting apparently was incredibly contentious, and that Tillerson and Bannon really sort of took him to task in a way that was disrespectful and even humiliating. And it seems, although there were the adults in the rooms, apparently Generals Mattis and McMaster, and I suppose Tillerson too, did the adults get rolled? Because it seems like the deal they made was, well, Trump will certify, reluctantly certify Iran for now, but now Bannon's in charge of a group of ideologues who are going to find a way to undo the deal in the next 90 days, and possibly find ways to resume sanctions against Iran and possibly open the way for some kind of military conflict.
Well, to answer your question, did the adults get rolled? I think the answer is time will tell. And I'd say there's a 90-day clock ticking in that respect. Just a factual point on the certification process. When the 2015 agreement was reached with Iran that included its commitments to restrict its nuclear activities, in particular, the programs for enriching uranium and producing plutonium, in exchange for lifting of U.S. and other international sanctions that had been put in place because Iran was pursuing these programs in violation of U.N. sanctions, when that deal was concluded, Congress passed legislation that requires the president to certify every 90 days that Iran is implementing the agreement and that suspension of U.S. sanctions can therefore proceed. So this is meant to be a factual process informed by the experts on the U.S. NSC staff, the National Security Council staff, that is, the Department of State, the Department of Defense. And so at this meeting 2 weeks ago with President Trump, and this was the second time the Trump administration has had to go through this 90-day certification process, his team, led by Secretary of State Tillerson, but also Secretary of Defense Mattis, the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dunford, all unanimously recommended the President make the certification to Congress on factual grounds and continue with the suspension of sanctions. So the President was upset. 90 days ago, he said, I want to be in a different place. He's called this deal, as you alluded to, the worst deal in history. And he was displeased that he got this unanimous recommendation from his four national security advisors. So that is what led him to turn, according to this foreign policy report, to his White House staffers, led by Steve Bannon, and basically say to them, I want to be in a different place 90 days from now. I want to be in position to decertify. So, you know, I think we are headed for what could be, you know, a number of defining moments in the Trump presidency based on the president's willingness to task an offline group. And by the way, just to underscore the point, he did a Wall Street Journal interview a couple days later where he was asked, would he overrule his staff on certification? And he said, quote, oh, sure, unquote. So that does appear to be the direction that they're headed.
But so was Bannon in that meeting? Because that was the impression I had gotten from some other people who said that, in fact, it was very contentious and that Trump not only has this obsession about anything that Obama did, we have to undo, and also he feels, whether he's trapped or whether he feels he's fulfilling these somewhat reckless campaign promises, like building a wall, that he has to do everything that he said on the campaign trail. But my understanding also is that being a businessman with no government background and certainly no diplomatic background, Trump basically kept asking the question, you know, what has this deal done for us? You know, like it's a business deal. And he's, because he's often on the campaign trail, inaccurately talked about how he gave all this money to the Iranians. Well, it wasn't that much money. And two, it was their money in the first place. And that apparently came up as well, you know. So is this a case of the adults trying to introduce reality to somebody that has a casual relationship with the truth?
Well, to answer your question, was Steve Bannon in the room during this conversation of the 90-day certification 2 weeks ago? I can only tell you that it appears so based on the reporting in foreign policy, but other reports and other news outlets and organizations, the New York Times, the Washington Post. And the answer that the president apparently gets when he asks the question, what's in this for us, is, in fact, the right answer, which is, first of all, Iran is complying with the commitments they made under this joint comprehensive plan of action that they reached with the international community 2 years ago. And secondly, what that does is it precludes Iran from developing a nuclear device over the next 15 years without warning time that they were violating the agreement, time that we would then have to take appropriate action. So he simply doesn't buy that, in part because he has a answer to the question about the Iran agreement that he gave during the campaign, which is it's the worst deal in history. So the notion of accepting the fact that there's something in it for us with respect to their nuclear program is not compelling to him. And as I say, I mean, this is going to be potentially a dramatic point of departure 90 days from now if the president goes down this road. First of all, I think it could lead to resignations within his national security team. Men like Tillerson, Mattis, McMaster, and now General Kelly, the new chief of staff, I think are unlikely to simply sit back and let Steve Bannon cherry-pick facts on the issue of Iran certification, certification that has to be made to Congress. Secondly, I think it's going to lead to, if they go down this road, an even more serious rupture with our European allies. As I said, this is an agreement that was negotiated by what's called the permanent five members of the UN Security Council plus Germany. So it included the UK, France, Germany, but also the European Union. And that is a group that's already upset with the president over his decision to withdraw from the Paris climate deal and also U.S. trade policies under Trump. So A move to decertify Iran without compelling evidence of violations, I think, could set off an even more serious rupture with Europe. Thirdly, it's going to lead to a more serious conflict with Iran, by definition, at a time when, to be frank, I think our focus needs to be on North Korea. And finally, and this is perhaps most important, I think when a president starts directing his White House staff to start cooking the books, that's usually a sign of bad things to come, including illegal acts. If you look back on the Nixon White House, the Watergate scandal, or the Reagan White House and Iran-Contra, both of those scandals began with a president who was frustrated by laws, facts, and conditions that they could not control. And in fact, the same was true in the George W. Bush White House on the question of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq or finding a connection between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. So when these things start to happen, someone somewhere is likely to step over or be pushed over a legal line. And when that happens, the consequences for the president and the administration can be quite severe.
And again, I'm speaking with Steve Andreessen, who was the Director for Defense Policy and Arms Control on the National Security Council staff from 1993 to 2001, and is currently a National Security Consultant at the Nuclear Threat Initiative. And he also teaches at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. And he has an article at the New York Times with Steve Simon, "Is Trump Scheming to Kill the Iran Deal?" Well, my understanding is that Bannon's only foreign policy experience was being in the United States Navy in the Gulf during the hostage crisis and the ill-fated rescue mission launched by Jimmy Carter. Apparently, according to this new book by the Wall Street Journal reporter, The Devil's Bargain, a book about Steve Bannon, that's where I interviewed him recently, and that's what he said, that sort of animates him, both his Islamophobic views from his experience in that part of the world, along with the sense of humiliation that went along with that failed hostage crisis. But there's also the other aspect, surely, of Donald Trump himself being so incredibly pro-Saudi following that successful trip that he had there where he did the sword dance and they threw a whole bunch of money at his daughter. So are we getting played by the Saudis? It's almost like, you know, the Saudis would love to go to war. They'd like to take out the regime in Tehran. But do they want to do that to the last American soldier?
Well, with respect to the Saudis and the Middle East and the situation with Iran as it pertains to certification, Mr. Trump has already taken a number of steps to isolate Iran in the first 6 months of his administration. And that relates to putting additional sanctions on Iran related to, in particular, their ballistic missile activities, which he can do, by the way, consistent with the Iran nuclear deal. But he's clearly closely aligned in that regard in terms of his suspicion and hostility to Iran behavior in the region with the Saudis and also the Israeli government. Both of them have, you know, made torpedoing the nuclear agreement a key goal in their relationship with Washington and have highlighted this in the Trump administration. And they also view a number of activities in the region, which of course are concerning, that Iran is instigating, whether it's in Yemen, whether it's with Hezbollah, with great suspicion and opposition. So Trump does seem eager to please them, that is, the Saudis and the Israelis, even at the risk of putting the Iran nuclear deal at risk. So, you know, you're in a situation where the United States is going to pay a price for aligning with the Saudis and other Gulf states and the Israelis if it puts at risk the Iran nuclear deal in order to align ever more closely with those states in the region who are hostile to Iran and would like to see regime change in Iran. And that price, in part, is going to be losing European friends and allies if we walk away from the Iran deal, who played such a key role in negotiating that agreement. And also, by the way, the Russians and the Chinese, who also won't support a U.S. effort to isolate Iran at the expense of the nuclear deal without evidence that Iran is violating that deal.
But Steve Andreessen, there's something that I find more troubling in this mix, is that Bannon, when he was at Breitbart, his most popular guest on his radio show was the founder of Blackwater, the mercenary army, Eric Prince. And apparently they have a very close relationship. And of course, Eric Prince is the brother of the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, in this administration. Eric Prince also has a mercenary army in the Emirates, in the Gulf. So if Bannon is getting his ideas from Eric Prince of how do you decertify Iran, how do you show that they're not living up to the agreement, how do you use the inspection process to your advantage and make all kinds of demands, he also has the possibility, does he not, of inflaming the situation if you've got a mercenary army with that highly volatile situation in the Straits of Hormuz with the Revolutionary Guard Corps speedboats. And let's face it, they're a bunch of nutcases to begin with, the IRGC. They're always trying to come up against American ships. And Trump himself once said, they better not come up too close to our beautiful ships. So that's what I think is the combustible situation that would only take a spark.
Well, one thing is true. Whether it's Steve Bannon or anyone else who's involved in the issue of Iran and the question of certification, looking ahead 90 days, and that is this. First of all, that certification takes place within a legal framework, that is the legislation passed by Congress 2 years ago. And within that framework, Congress is very clear as to what the president is asked to certify. The president is asked to certify whether or not Iran is in fact complying with its commitments under that deal. So that is a factual determination. And, you know, when the president certifies or doesn't certify to Congress that Iran is in compliance, they're going to have to state the facts. And that presumably is going to be a constraint on the administration in the context of making a compelling case to Congress or the public that Iran either is or isn't in compliance with the deal. The second thing is true, again, whether Steve Bannon or anything else, is that there is a process that is going to be followed. And that process has to be credible. And by process, I'm talking about process within the administration. It's going to be very interesting to see how the new chief of staff, General Kelly, for example, reacts to what was done 2 weeks ago, which is to task a offline White House group coming up with a Team B on the issue of certification. Because by definition, the president has apparently asked them to produce the facts that allow him not to certify. And if those facts aren't in evidence, it'll be very interesting to see how General Kelly puts up with a process that develops fact not in evidence, particular if the online process, that is, that being done by Secretary of State Tillerson, Secretary of Defense Mattis, the National Security Advisor McMaster, produces a different answer, which they did 2 weeks ago, which is that Iran is complying with the agreement. So, you know, this is an administration where often facts don't seem to matter. And, of course, there's nothing to prevent the president or anyone involved in the process in making things up. But this is going to be a case where those facts are going to be exposed to the light of day. And that will be a constraint. And if they choose to, not abide by that constraint, again, that's when I think you're going to see problems within the administration, possibly resignations, problems in Europe in terms of our relations with key allies, problems obviously in the region, in particular, raising the risk of a conflict with Iran. And as I say, problems for the president and his political future when he starts asking people to concoct facts to support his positions.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I hope we can revisit this, and I hope it doesn't turn out as badly as it might well. And it's as your article in the New York Times mentions today, Steve Andreessen, it's bad enough to have the North Korea crisis looming, let alone create a crisis with Iran. So I thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Ian. Always a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Steve Andreessen, who was a director for Defense Policy and Arms Control on the National Security Council staff from 1993 to 2001, and is currently a National Security Consultant at the Nuclear Threat Initiative, and he teaches at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. And he has an article at the New York Times with Steve Simon, "Is Trump Scheming to Kill the Iran Deal?" We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining further the likelihood of Trump starting a war with Iran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Trita Parsi, who is a co-founder and the president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. He has an article at Alternet, "This October, Trump will try to start a war with Iran. Trump plans to sabotage the nuclear deal." Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Foreign Policy had a report about this contentious meeting that took place a week or so ago in the White House, where Trump grudgingly signed the certification that Iran was sticking with the P5+1 deal that Obama signed and that Trump has always criticized. So walk us through what you understand has happened here in terms of a kind of compromise in order to sign the deal, which he did grudgingly. Trump's basically put a bunch of White House hawks in charge of a plan to find a way in 90 days to basically break the deal and, as you suggest, even go further and start a war with Iran.
Yeah, I mean, the reporting has been, I mean, one of the things I think we almost have to be happy about is that the Trump administration is not trying to conceal its intent here. They're very clear that they're trying to kill this deal, and that they're trying to do so by being quite dishonest about it, because he's ordered his staff to go and find a way to claim that Iran is out of compliance, even though it's extremely clear at this point that Iran actually is in compliance. He's made it clear that he never wanted to certify Iran in the first place, regardless as to whether Iran was in compliance or not. So the fix is in. He is trying to find a way to claim that Iran is cheating, whereas in reality, the International Atomic Energy Agency has made it quite clear that Iran is not cheating, that it actually is in compliance.
Well, I think the Saudi element here you can't deny, because, as you know, Trump had his successful foreign policy visit, probably about the only one that he can claim was a great success, with the photo op, with the dancing with the Saudis, the sword dance and everything. But what went on there, from my understanding, was that the Saudis are essentially buying the White House. The boy king, Mohammed bin Salman, has given Ivanka Trump $100 million for her foundation. My understanding is that the Saudis, the Al Saud family, led by MBS, basically told the Trumps, and Jared is now MBS's best friend, that we're going to finance your re-election. So is there also that element here that we have a corrupt president?
There certainly seems to be an element of this kind. Clearly, that trip was quite instrumental for Trump. And the reason why an explanation along those lines is needed is because there is no strategic justification for what Donald Trump is doing right now. This deal is working. It has taken both war with Iran and an Iranian path to a nuclear weapon off the table. If you kill the deal, both of those disastrous situations are back on the table. The only way one can envision Trump agreeing to this is because the Saudis have promised to help him in many different ways, and one way is also for them to start investing a lot in the United States and trying to get the economy going. So essentially, he is auctioning out America's foreign policy and America's national security.
Well, but the consequences down the line, as you just pointed out, Dr. Tridipasi, are horrendous, because if you break the nuclear deal with Iran, Iran, from what I understand, could move fairly quickly to a nuclear weapon, and then Saudi Arabia would then move to a nuclear weapon and probably buy one or several from Pakistan, and you'd have a nuclear arms race. But the idea of nuclear weapons in the hands of Mohammed bin Salman, who's already shown his immaturity and impetuousness in going into Yemen without an exit strategy, where he's now bogged down, and this ridiculous blockade against Qatar, which is going nowhere. That's what worries me, is that people make the case that you can't have nuclear weapons in the hands of the supreme leader and the mullahs, but I'm even more afraid of nuclear weapons in the hands of Mohammed bin Salman, the boy king of Saudi Arabia.
What I would actually say that even without nuclear weapons, Mohammed bin Salman has shown himself to be a tremendously reckless ruler and tremendously incapable. I think the scenario that will play out is that if the deal falls apart and if the Iranians then decide to restart their program, then Donald Trump will have his casus belli and he will start a war. And that's exactly what the Saudis want. As the former Secretary of Defense, Bob Gates, said, that the Saudis want to fight the Iranians to the last American. They've been dying to get to see a war between the United States and Iran, because that's what they think is needed in order for Saudi Arabia to be able to tilt the balance of power in the region in its favor. Itself, it cannot take on the Iranians, but it has no problems buying the Americans to do so. And with a president like Trump, he seems to be more than happy to sell, regardless of the loss of American life, as well as the tremendous danger this will be to U.S. national security. So I don't think necessarily that the Saudis will get a bomb. I think what we'll have is a military confrontation in the region of a very, very large scale prior to that.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Tridipasi, who's the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and the author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. He has an article at Alternet. This October, Trump will try to start a war with Iran. Trump plans to sabotage the nuclear deal. Now, my understanding of the meeting that took place at the White House that was very contentious, that Stephen Bannon actually just ripped into Tillerson in a way that was so undignified. And apparently, I don't know whether you've read the book, Tridipasi, by Joshua Green, Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. Have you had a chance to look at that?
I haven't had a chance to read it yet, no, but I heard about it.
Well, what it makes clear is that Stephen Bannon's worldview and his hatred of Islam and his Islamophobia comes from experience with the U.S. Navy in the Gulf during the hostage crisis and the botched rescue attempt by Jimmy Carter. Apparently, that was his formative kind of vision of foreign policy, and he basically, that's where he's coming from in terms of what very little foreign policy credentials he has. But nevertheless, the people there in the room, the McMaster and Mattis and company, they won the day in terms of getting Trump to at least certify the deal for the time being. In 90 days' time, it's a whole different ballgame when he has to do it again, as you pointed out in your article. But how long can these guys, the so-called adults...
I think there's an important point to be made here, that even though Tillerson and Mattis won the day at this specific meeting, their argument was not that, look, this deal is working. Why are you messing with it? Why are you risking war and Iran getting a nuclear weapon by wanting to decertify them when it's so clear that they're actually living up to their end of the bargain? Their argument was that there should be a better way of decertifying them. There should be a better way that costs the U.S. less to be able to get out of this deal. And that's where this effort of trying to go and request access to Iran's non-nuclear sites in a way that clearly is fraudulent and as a result will cause the Iranians to say no, and then use that as a pretext to say, look, the Iranians are not abiding and as a result we have to walk out of the deal. So their argument is just to do the same thing but do it a little bit more cleverly so that the cost will be less and that some of the blame can be shifted over to the Iranians. The debate is not between those who say, look, this deal is working, why are you messing with it, and those who are against it. The debate is between those who want to recklessly collapse the deal and those who want to do it in a more sophisticated way.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, we take comfort in the idea that there are adults in the room, like Mattis, McMaster, and now General Kelly, but it's not exactly clear how much they are in the room and who he really listens to. And my sense is that this man has an obsessive hatred of Barack Obama. Anything Obama did, he has to undo. He also has a businessman's approach. He has no idea about foreign policy, let alone diplomacy. So to him, his argument is, what are we getting out of this deal? Apparently that's what he was saying in this meeting. And the Darth Vader behind the scenes whispering in his ear, Steve Bannon, was also pushing that. And apparently he was extremely rude to Tillerson, who now has talked to some of his friends and said maybe he's not going to last the year. My understanding is that if these generals made some kind of deal to do this duplicitous way to undo the deal so the American fingerprints aren't all over it, why would they have agreed to let Bannon be in charge of this attempt to undo the P5+1 deal, which is apparently what's happened? I mean, isn't that putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank?
It certainly is, and I don't think they had the power to prevent it. I mean, Trump reluctantly agreed not to decertify it now, but he was upset with them because they had not come up with a plan for him to decertify it. They did not even come with an option of decertification because it's not an option if you care and try to at least abide by international law in a minimal sense. So he gave the task to someone who was against the deal and who wants to quickly find a way of decertification. And I don't think Mattis and Trump and Tillerson and others had any option but to essentially acquiesce because they're not the president. Trump is.
And is there been some talk that Mattis has a pretty hardline attitude towards Iran? What's the basis of that? Is it true? And two, what's the basis of it?
I don't know about Tillerson's approach to Iran, except for the fact that if you have been executive at an American oil company for the last 3 decades, that means that you have exclusively worked on the southern side of the Persian Gulf, meaning with the GCC states and Saudi Arabia. And their thinking may have influenced him because his knowledge about Iran seems to be quite minimal, to be completely frank, based on public statements. Mattis's case is a little bit more complex. You have here a Marine who still holds a grudge, not only because of what happened in the Marine barracks in 1983 in Lebanon, where Hezbollah, backed by the Iranians, killed a large number of American Marines, but also because of the experience in Iraq and Afghanistan, in which they believe that both the Obama administration and the Bush administration were not tough enough with the Iranians, that they were not inflicting a cost on them for the damage they were doing to U.S. soldiers. They hold them responsible for the death of a large number of U.S. soldiers killed by IEDs, etc. But there's also, I think, a different dimension there. Mattis, based on his comments, etc., seems to believe that the United States should have a position of hard hegemony in the Middle East, that the Obama administration was wrong in trying to pivot to Asia and shift its focus towards Asia. And if you want to have strong hegemony in the Middle East, you will be in a clash with the Iranians because they have opposed any external power having hegemony in the region, and they did so during the time of the Shah as well. And you will turn a blind eye to the common interests that exist between the United States and Iran, such as the fight against ISIS. And you will turn a blind eye against the many sins that the Saudis are committing in spreading terrorism and killing Americans. Because at the end of the day, the Saudis want to see the United States have hard hegemony in the Middle East. The Israelis want to see the United States have hard hegemony in the Middle East. So that higher objective trumps all of these other contradictory interests between Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the United States, just as much as the common interest that the United States and Iran has also is trumped by the fact that Iran and the United States are at odds with each other when it comes to who controls the region.
Well, but at the heart of it is the domestic Iranian politics, and that's always been a very tenuous situation in terms of reform. And obviously, if there's a war against Iran, the Iranians, being patriotic, will flock to the defense of their country, even if they don't like the supreme leader, the IRGC, and the hardliners who have disproportionate power and control. What we understand is that Rouhani, the leader, has to play a very delicate game in trying to get anything done because of the system is so rigged in favor of the hardliners that it requires great subtlety to undo their power. But the Americans are going to hand, or Trump is going to hand these guys, these hardliners, a gift. I mean, they already handed them. They got rid of their two enemies, the Taliban on one side and Saddam Hussein on the other. I mean, you'd more or less want to ask the hardliners in Iran, what are you guys complaining about? You know, America's been the gift that keeps on giving. But if Trump starts a war, then that is a further gift to the Iranian hardliners, isn't it?
It certainly would be. I mean, the hardliners were afraid of the nuclear deal, not necessarily because of the details of the deal, but because they were afraid that the Rouhani government and the moderates would get a major domestic political bump out of this that would last a decade, perhaps a generation, and that the deal would tilt the domestic political balance of power against the hardliners. If the United States kills the deal and by that vindicates the hardliners, vindicates Ayatollah Khamenei, who said, I'll go along with this, but I'm uncomfortable with it because I don't trust the United States. The United States will cheat on this deal. And lo and behold, not even a year and a half into it, we have a president that openly says that he's looking for ways to killing the deal. This is really hurting Rouhani domestically, particularly if the Trump administration succeeds with killing the deal. And it will end up being, instead of a bump for the moderates, it can end up being a major gift for the hardliners for a decade to come. It will be so difficult for any future Iranian president to argue internally that there is a value in negotiating with the United States if Trump kills this deal.
Well, but if he goes to war, then all bets are off, right? I mean, people are going to rally around the flag, aren't they?
Oh, certainly. If it goes to war, all bets are off. And that will not only see the moderates lose out, but it will also set back the cause of democracy in Iran for a full generation.
Well, Dr. Tridipasi, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Tridipasi, who is a co-founder and the president of the National Iranian American Council and the author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. He has an article at Alternet. This October, Trump will try to start a war with Iran. Trump plans to sabotage the nuclear deal. We're going to take a restation break. We're back looking into why Trump is imposing sanctions on Venezuela's new dictator, Maduro, while praising Turkey's Erdogan for his recent electoral coup.
Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't. Destruction.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Max Hoffman, the Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, where his research focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Hoffman.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, Max. And there was a press conference just a couple of days ago where General McMaster and the Secretary of Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, addressed the press. Mnuchin, of course, was introducing sanctions against Venezuela and against the Maduro government for essentially ending any pretense of democracy in Venezuela. And a reporter asked Mnuchin and McMaster, what's the difference with what happened in Turkey, where Donald Trump, in fact, praised the Turkish leader in what many people saw was a power grab. And the Europeans, of course, did not endorse this power grab and didn't feel that it was transparent in terms of the referendum itself. So, of course, Mnuchin didn't answer it because he's a total toady and just basically doesn't answer questions. But McMaster did step up to the mic and more or less said, well, you know, there's a difference between Venezuela and Turkey, and Venezuela is clearly a case where all pretenses ended and democracy is being killed before our eyes. So you're a student of Turkey. How much do you think Turkish democracy is being killed before our eyes?
Well, Ian, I don't envy, General McMaster, that question. It's a very, very difficult one. And, of course, for him, he's also contending with the U.S. government's need to sort of balance national security interests and interests in the Middle East, for which we, of course, need Turkish cooperation at some level with the, you know, the kind of normative and moral question that you ask. I think that unquestionably over the last 5 years or so, the trends began before that, but certainly over the last 4 or 5 years, Turkey has shifted from a sort of status maybe as a troubled democracy to something that is approaching an authoritarian state. Of course, you know, President Erdogan and the governing AKP can still claim a popular mandate, and there are still elections that, in terms of the vote counting, are still regarded as free, but not fair, because the context in which those elections are taking place is completely sort of stage managed and very tightly controlled by the government. That's to include, of course, strict controls on the freedom of the press and expression, limits on opposition parties' ability to organize rallies, and, you know, in the last year and a half, the outright jailing of political opponents and duly elected parliamentarians of opposition parties. So, I don't know exactly what the right term would be, perhaps a managed democracy or sort of borderline authoritarian state. But the signs in Turkey are very, very troubling. And I think, you know, I'm not an expert on Venezuela by any stretch of the imagination, but certainly that the chaos in that country shows where things can go when a government in a vibrant and diverse country loses its legitimacy and its ability to arbitrate political disputes. And, you know, if you drive all political dissent underground, the only place it emerges is in the streets, as we're seeing in Venezuela and hopefully will not see in Turkey. But it's a very worrying situation.
Well, surely, though, the military coup that took place a little over a year ago, right, in fact, was a gift to Erdogan, to the extent that some analysts think he may have somehow orchestrated it. I don't know that there's any proof for that. But surely that is, the anti-democratic actions of principally the Air Force have basically given Erdogan a lot of cover in terms of him rolling back democracy, because they just celebrated on the anniversary of the coup. They celebrated the restoration of democracy. I mean, what an irony.
That's right. And Erdogan himself called it a gift from God in the wake of the coup attempts. The speculation that it was, you know, a managed coup, as the opposition has called it, or a false flag operation, as some have said. There is no proof of that. I think the consensus among Turkey analysts right now is that it was a legitimate coup that was orchestrated by elements within the military to include Gulenists, as the AKP claims, and also likely sort of secularists and other opponents of the course of the AKP government. But that likely it was, you know, some of the people who were sort of sitting on the fence and waiting to see which way it went bailed on the plan, or potentially there were behind-the-scenes negotiations with the Turkish intelligence service to avert a full-blown coup. It's really unclear. What's remarkable, I mean, all of that effectively is speculation, because what's remarkable is that even now, 13 months almost, or, you know, 12 and a half months after the coup attempt, how little we know, and how little the Turkish public knows. The coup trials are, you know, ramping up now, and so in the indictments, the government is releasing more details of what happened on that night. But still, it's a very sort of unclear and fragmented picture that outside observers and Turkish citizens have of the events, and that, of course, leaves a lot of room for speculation. What's certain, though, is that the aftermath of the coup attempt has been used, in a very strong manner by President Erdogan to eliminate all remaining sources of political opposition. He was paranoid before this coup attempt, and, you know, the old saying, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you, probably applies here. And so now he is convinced that, that he won't be safe until he has complete and, political control, and he's working towards that goal.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Hoffman, who's Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, where his research focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions. Now, in terms of foreign interference, and of course, Erdogan did try to blame it on the U.S., and certainly the press that he controls now were echoing that because of the Air Force was involved, and I don't know whether it involved Incirlik, the NATO base, or not, but there were reports at the time that it did. I've also learned from intelligence sources that the Emiratis have fingerprints over this too. So what kind of foreign involvement was there?
Going back to the last point, we really don't have a clear picture. Some government voices and really widespread figures in the pro-AKP press have blamed the coup attempt on the United States or the Emiratis and various other foreign powers. That's not surprising. I mean, Turkey's a very nationalist country. It's deeply suspicious, particularly the AKP constituency, deeply suspicious of the West, and particularly the United States. And certainly the Emirates, the UAE is no friend of the AKP government or, you know, Islamist governments anywhere in the region. And so that's given rise to all of this speculation. You know, in addition, the fact there were mid-air refueling tankers that flew from Incirlik on the night of the coup attempt, although the F-16s were flying from other bases. People who believe the U.S. was behind it also point to the fact that some of the units involved in the attempt were part of NATO's Rapid Response Force. But, there were also many units who were not part of it that participated. So there's really no evidence of it, but that hasn't stopped the conspiracy theories. And, really, Erdogan and the AKP have stoked those theories and stoked that narrative. The reason for that is their whole political message and the party's sort of pitch to its constituents is very much a populist message based on a sense of victimization and based on hostility towards the other. And very frequently, the other is the United States and the West. The reason for that is that Erdogan is trying to hold together his religious conservative and sort of Islamist base with the Turkish nationalist constituency, which is very important to his political goals at home. And one of the few things that marries those two groups, that holds them together, the things they agree on, is hostility towards the West and the belief that the U.S. is sort of an imperialist power and that foreign powers are conspiring to try and hold Turkey back and weaken Turkey and potentially even divide Turkey. And so the narrative is very politically powerful for Erdogan, and that's, I think, why he has used it and sort of egged on those people in the press who are saying the U.S. was behind it. But again, there's no evidence that anyone has produced that really points in that direction.
Well, these show trials that he put on, where he's got 500 defendants, all being marched in through a cordon of demonstrators, many of whom were the families of people that were killed during the coup. Obviously, you know, they're pretty riled up. It all seemed incredibly staged by Erdogan, and of course he has taken over all the press. So what's the point, though? I mean, one of the main defendants in this, being accused of being a coup plotter, is Adil Oksuz, a theology lecturer. Now, I can't believe in a theology lecturer put together that coup involving F-16s, et cetera, et cetera. That seems like a gratuitous swipe at Gulen.
Well, so to the you bring up, I think, two very good points. The first is the, you know, what these trials are meant to achieve, and for the reasons I mentioned before, Erdogan is sort of trying to build a new national myth almost, and one that unifies the religious conservatives with Turkish nationalists. And the coup attempt is sort of the founding myth for that narrative. And that's why you saw on the anniversary of the coup attempt essentially a national almost celebration, like glorifying the response to the coup attempt and its defeat. And it was almost, you know, it was about keeping that spirit alive because it helps stoke that sense of victimhood. It helps motivate the AKP's constituents against their political opponents, and it's also a useful distraction to the, you know, the kind of sorry state of the economy and the country overall, and Erdogan's authoritarianism. These trials, as you said, you know, I don't think you'd march the defendants through this public corridor of shame almost if you weren't prejudging them to some extent. These have the feel of a show trial, despite the fact that many of these people, you know, likely were involved in the coup attempt and really should face justice. This is more about political messaging, or as much about political messaging as about justice, it seems to me. You know, the second point about Adil Oksuz and the connection to Gulen is also a very interesting one. It's something out of a spy thriller. The government's explanation of what happened. They believe that the Gulen movement over a period of 2 or 3 decades infiltrated state institutions and the military and bided their time and then secretly plotted this big coup attempt to overthrow the government. It's very difficult to believe that that's what happened. It's easier to believe that elements of the Gulen movement were involved, but that this was a huge conspiracy, constructed over years is hard to reconcile with the reality of a messy Turkish political life. Adil Oksuz, of course, he is said to have traveled back and forth to the United States to see Gulen, over 100 times over the last few years. So there's really, it's hard to corroborate or disprove any of these Turkish government claims. And the fact is that they've so politicized the judicial system that their opponents within the country and many unbiased outside observers have a tough time believing everything they say.
Well, on the surface, it doesn't seem like a very democratic or helpful thing to have a kind of fifth column of a religious secretive organization like, you know, the Scientologists or something like that, that have their people in every branch of the government, the judiciary, the education, and the military. And so, but it also seems that Erdogan is using this specter of this fifth column for his own purposes. So how destructive have, because my friend Graham Fuller says that he thinks that the Gulen movement actually is a very hopeful thing in Islam, and certainly the opposite direction from what the Wahhabis and the hardliners have taken that religion, and we've seen what destruction that's caused around the world. But one of Gulen's exhortations to his wealthy donors is, don't build mosques, build schools. So they don't seem to be this kind of, you know, diabolical specter that Erdogan is trying to present.
You're right. There are elements of truth in both narratives, but both ignore part of the picture. Part of the problem is the AKP and Erdogan have insisted on this degree of collective punishment that really undermines their argument. The Gulen movement was a very large community, and they had lots of civil society groups. They had schools and businesses. They had, they were involved with civic life in Turkey and elsewhere. It's impossible to believe that you know, this was all some sinister operation. They were people, and they pursued interests and became involved and formed organizations like any group of people. Equally, however, the movement was very insular and non-transparent. There is evidence, reliable evidence, that they tried to place members of the community in positions of power. Now, you know, nobody who's spent time in Washington or any other capital will be terribly surprised that there's nepotism going on in politics. But in 2013, we had, you know, there was the break between the AKP and the Gulen movement, and prosecutors and police officials believed to be Gulenists revealed massive corruption at the highest levels of the AKP government, and that's where the split began. It's clear that there was corruption in the government. It's also clear that these prosecutors were trying to sort of manufacture the overthrow of the government. So there's truth on both sides. I think the most likely reality is somewhere in the middle, that there was a wide social movement, many of whom are blameless and are now caught up in this post-coup crackdown and have had their lives ruined by an unfair and, you know, immoral response, and that there was a small group of people who probably were conspiring and likely were involved in the coup attempt. And you really can't, you couldn't pick a worse, maybe couldn't pick a worse government to manage that sort of duality and the nuance of the situation than the current Erdogan AKP government, who is, you know, deeply paranoid, very insular, very nationalistic, and afraid for their political and personal survival. So in this politically fraught context, all of that has gone out the window, and there's this collective punishment and this lack of due process that's really worrying, and is of course part of a wider authoritarian trend in the country.
Well, just in the last minute, Max Hoffman, what do you make of the fact that Erdogan has reshuffled the military and he's fired the heads of all three military branches?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was coming. He did keep the chief of Hulusi Akar, the chief of the military, in place. Listen, the Turkish state is very fragmented in the wake of the coup attempt, and the Turkish military in particular. Erdogan needs to assert complete control, or he will not feel safe. And the question half the country that does not support Erdogan is, what is he building in the place of the old state, and how he's building it, really without any input from those who disagree with him. So we'll see. But the Turkish military and the Turkish state will remain in flux and, you know, sadly, likely chaos for some time. This is a hugely traumatic event.
Well, Max Hoffman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. Always good to talk to you.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Max Hoffman, who's the Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, where his research focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.